Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs Committee to order at 3:20 p.m. Tuesday, April 10th, in the Max Grinberg Room of the Alaska Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Wolf? Here. Chair Price Tompkins? Here.
And with five members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. We have a lengthy agenda today. First hearing on H.J.R. 41, a constitutional amendment relating to percent of market value that can be drawn from the permanent fund. Her first hearing on H.B. 409, relating to DMV, ID cards, and registration fees. A first hearing of Senate Bill 204 from Senator Egan, relating to disabled veterans plates and certification by chiropractors. A first hearing of H.J.R. 30, urging U.S. support of refugees from Representative Josephson. And a first hearing of SB 196, an appropriation limit from the Senate Finance Committee that will be presented by Senators Machiki and Von Imhoff. Representative Johnson, do you have a question or comment?
I do have a question. Do you have plans to move any of the bills today?
No. Yeah, I just as a matter of course, try to have two hearings on everything, no matter how perfunctory, as we saw with the resolution on April's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. That was a real controversial one, but we held it for two hearings. Okay, first item on the agenda, H.J.R. 41. This is going to be co-presented by Reed Magdans in my office and Rob Irving from Representative Johnston's office. Again, just a first hearing, informational. Mr. Magdans, Mr. Irving, please put yourself on the record and present the legislation. And I should also note that Angela Riddell, the CEO of the Permanent Fund Corporation, is here for questions, and I intend to ask a few myself, and David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance, will be here when Senate Finance Committee adjourns. Mr. Magdans, Mr. Irving, welcome.
Robert Irving, Staff to Representative Jennifer Johnston.
Reed Magdans, Staff to Chair Christ Tompkins. I'll start the presentation. This is Reed. This constitutional amendment essentially does two things. It caps the draws on the permanent fund to a sustainable 4.75% of market value, and it prevents ad hoc draws on the earnings reserve account. In other words, prevents any draws above that 4.75% threshold. The amendment maintains the principal and the earnings reserve account as separate accounts and prevents any spending from the principal account.
This is Robert. I think the only thing I'd like to add is this: we see this as kind of the points that we've heard the most consensus around kind of in the legislature as a whole. It seems like a lot of legislators think ad hoc draws, bad idea, changes the way the fund's managed, and that we need some kind of sustainable draw. So these are kind of the consensus points at the start of a conversation.
Questions from the committee? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any reason we can't do this in statute right now? Noting what a hurdle it is to get anything through kind of the whole constitutional amendment process and whatnot. I mean, basically, at this point, the $40 billion in the fund, as I understand it, is fully fenced off and it's constitutionally protected via the 1976 vote, or the public voted to do the permanent fund in the Constitution. But is there any reason we couldn't set something similar to this up that had the same net result and just do it today in statute through the chair?
Through the chair, this is Robert. So currently the principal is fenced off, as you mentioned, but the whole earnings reserve account is subject to appropriation, and really the only way to make that meaningfully protected is putting it in the Constitution.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess two questions. One, when you say the consensus is amongst the legislators or legislature, that's just in anecdotal water cooler discussions, obviously, right? You're not talking with everyone having an in-depth conversation. That's just sort of your vibe from the people you happen to run into, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And I might just add a little bit, Representative Wohl. I mean, the sort of other iteration of this kind of idea is where you include a percent that goes to dividends and a percent available for appropriation for public services. It could be 50-50, it could be 25-75. There's all different versions. And just not even going there and just starting with the most basic notion, which is what is the sustainable draw of the permanent fund?
Thank you for that. A follow-up question would be, when you said that this would prevent ad hoc draws out of the earnings reserve constitutionally, but yet there'd still be an earnings reserve and a permanent fund corpus, if there's no ad hocs out of the earnings reserve, how do you prevent that? B, if that's the case, what is it for? What would the earnings reserve, what would the delineation be for if you can't pull any money out of it? And then why wouldn't you just merge it all into one?
Reed Migdens, for the record, Representative Wohl through the chair. The main effect of not merging the accounts is that under this amendment, the $40 billion that's in the principal that Representative Birch mentioned would remain untouchable and unspendable. And if you say had immediately after passing this amendment had a significant market downturn, that $40 billion would remain protected and would still be unavailable for spending in under any scenario.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I thought you said on your introduction that this bill would prevent any ad hoc draws out of the earnings reserve, so that therefore the earnings reserve would simply be the vehicle from which, or the entity from which, the 4.75% is drawn. It's sort of the checking account and one's a savings account. But if there's no draws from it, it could ostensibly sort of be looked at the same, right? When I say no draws, other than the 4.75%.
Yeah. Representative Wohl, through the chair, I think to illustrate, imagine a scenario, this has never happened, but imagine a scenario where for the next 8 years the permanent fund earned zero returns. If you were drawing 5% a year, you could potentially see the earnings reserve drawn down to zero. By maintaining a separate principal, you would then have no money available to draw. Whereas if you combine the two funds, you could continue to draw 5% forever.
Last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under that scenario, if the corpus was separate from the earnings reserve, or the principal, and the earnings reserve is used for your draw of 4.75%, and the earnings reserve, the yield, the earnings was zero, as you said, for 8 years, earnings reserve would go to zero, we couldn't tap into the principal, then you'd be in the dilemma of what do we do now? Since you can't tap into the principal, earnings reserve is drained, we're down to zero of money for funding public services or government, whatever you want to call it.
Representative Wohl, through the chair, that's correct. The state would have to find the money to fund its budget from a different source.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is that current, is that not very similar to what we have today? I mean, the earnings reserve account is separate from the principal amount. And the principal amount's already protected, and the corpus is already protected in the Constitution. No way of touching that. So other than the structured draw at 4.75, I don't really see a whole lot of difference in what you're proposing other than to protect it under the Constitution. Am I on track with that or not?
Through the chair, yes, you're on track with that.
Okay, so then I have to, this might be a question for Ms. Rodale, but I'm having a little trouble figuring out. So in Title 34 right now, it talks about the formula for the structured draw. When you mentioned that all of the earnings reserve was subject to appropriation, but under 34.130, whatever it is, under Title 34, that lays out the structured draw, and it talks about the inflation proofing, and members of the public argue that we are breaking our own laws by not following them. And I'm somewhat leaning towards agreeing with them in that sense. So when you say that everything in earnings reserve account is subject to appropriations, I'm kind of wondering what is there is legal opinion or something that saying that, I mean, we put it in formula, in statute, what we're supposed to do, and we're not really doing that. So help me out with why are we doing what we're doing?
Yeah, Representative Knopp, through the chair, Reed Magdens, for the record. I believe what we mean by that is that the legislature could this year, with 21 votes, choose to take all $16 billion in the earnings reserve and put it in the constitutional budget reserve. It could choose to spend it all in a single year if it wanted to. This amendment, this constitutional amendment, would prevent that from happening. It would say really, truly, the legislature can only spend 4.75% of market value.
And I understand that, but I guess what I'm trying to ask, Mr. Chairman, is I guess what I'm trying to ask, if we were following our own statutes right now, we wouldn't have that option, would we? Where does it say that it's all subject to appropriation? I mean, it doesn't appear that, in fact, we're actually following laws we created a few years back. That's where I'm. You might have an answer for me, or maybe Mr. O'Dell does, but she's shaking her head, yes. But I kind of need to have that answered for me, Mr. Chairman. You know, I mean, it isn't statute, and if we were following the statute, we wouldn't be talking about putting it in the Constitution.
Representative Knopp, through the chair, the problem is that the legislature doesn't have to follow its statutes when it comes to the budget process.
Does that answer your question, Representative Knopp?
Well, it doesn't make it right, Mr. Chairman. We put that in statute for a reason, you know. So, I guess I'll leave it at that for now. Thank you.
Yeah, and Representative Birch?
Just a question on, we've used, through the chair, a couple different terms for the permanent fund. On the statement here, the sponsor statement, it indicates that you want to prevent unsustainable spending that threatens the future value of the fund. And, I think that $40 billion, if you will, it's in the corpus, that's pretty well fenced off, is it not, without some sort of a constitutional question in front of the voters or something? I don't see how you can erode the corpus of the fund. I mean, I understand the earnings that are per the 1976 amendment that basically move those dollars into the general fund. I get that, but the corpus is that's not threatened in any way, is it? Through the chair.
Representative Birch, through the chair, Reed Magdans. You're correct that the $40 billion attributed to the principal is untouchable currently. The question to be had with this amendment is that the total fund value, including the earnings reserve right now, is $66 billion roughly. The difference between those two numbers, namely $26 billion, is not constitutionally protected at the moment. This amendment would protect all $66 billion currently in the permanent fund.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard a lot recently about the legislature not following statute, I guess breaking the law with no repercussions. And I know that the last 2 years the statutory formula for the PFD has not been adhered to. Have there been any other instances where that's happened? Because I keep hearing about it. But I know the governor vetoed it a few years ago. Then we passed a less than statutory formula. And this year looks like we're on track to do it again. Are there any other instances that you can, or is it a common occurrence? I haven't been here that long, so I don't know.
Through the chair, this is Robert. A good example that comes to mind and is pertinent right now would be the 90-day limit. The voters in 2006 passed an initiative limiting the legislature to a 90-day session, and we've blown by it 8 of the last 10 years, I think.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Riddell, would you be available for questions? And maybe start with a question that Representative Knopp flagged. If Representative Knopp, that would be helpful.
Yeah, it would be helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. In answer to your question, Representative Knopp, the Constitution creating the Permanent Fund is very clear that the amounts on deposit in the fund will be used for income-producing investments only, the income of which shall go to the general fund. The legislature has been given the power of appropriation over the general fund. So that is the mechanism by which you have the ability to fully appropriate the earnings reserve account, because the earnings reserve account became the repository rather than going directly to the general fund. The legislature's statute through statute created a sub-fund, if you will, of the general fund that is the earnings reserve account.
And then there's also another sub-account of that where you're required to put in 50% of the projected dividend payments out of the earnings reserve account. Is that, didn't I read another provision in that? And so I guess I understand what you're saying in that. So if that's the case, why is it that we put that formula in statute? Was it almost recommended language but not mandatory? Is that... as far as the formula for payout, permanent fund dividend payouts? And
through the chair, Representative Knopp, there was a lot of my understanding of just through what I've read. Obviously, I wasn't here at the time for the debate as to how the permanent fund would be used or how that income would be used. Part of it was to bifurcate that debate and leave that debate for days like today, which is why the constitutional language is, for the permanent fund, is actually very clean and very simple. And this was the compromise that was achieved through statutory, and it was in place up until 2016. I think one of the interesting historical observations I would make is that the statutory language says that 50% of the income available for distribution shall be transferred for the permanent fund dividend program. But there's no discussion of what the other 50% of the amount available for distribution was to be used for. And at times, that was used for inflation proofing. Inflation proofing is another example of a statute that has not been fulfilled since 2016. It was appropriated back into the principal of the fund. We have almost $7 billion of additional appropriations outside of inflation proofing and royalty deposits that comprise the $40 billion of the corpus of the fund. So that one might argue that 50% is the amount that was available for state services that over the years legislatures chose not to appropriate, but rather leave behind to build up the balance in the earnings reserve account.
So I'll just wrap up here. Thanks for that explanation. I thought that somewhere in history I saw a legal memo that talked about the powers of appropriation, and that's how we got around that. And I haven't been able to find that since then, and I was looking for that. I'm not sure that I support constitutionalizing this. Actually, I'm pretty sure I don't. But I sure would support the inflation proofing in the Constitution. And so my question, last and final question, is I asked why we're not inflation proofing this year, and they said, well, the fund made 12%, and we think that's more than enough to offset inflation proofing. And so your opinion on that?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, we strongly disagree with that. The principal of the account only gets what the legislature chooses to appropriate back in outside of the mandatory 25%. So all of those earnings are available for appropriation. None of it, not one penny of it, is available to the principal of the account. And if I might respond to your earlier comment, in the Willikowski versus State of Alaska Supreme Court decision, there was a great deal of discussion as to the powers of appropriation on the earnings reserve account. and the requirement of an appropriation for both a dividend and inflation proofing. And so that decision was made in 2017 by the Alaska Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you.
On the subject of inflation proofing, I might need a refresher of the House and Senate operating budgets. Are neither of them inflation proofing this year?
So the budget that was passed by the House and sent over to the Senate includes inflation proofing of $942 million for FY19. It does not include restoring the inflation proofing amounts totaling $1.4 billion from FY16 through FY18. In the current committee substitute that the Senate Finance Committee is debating or discussing, there is no inflation proofing in that proposed committee substitute.
And so just to, I thank you, just to note that in the last, three of the last 4 years we have an inflation proof, but this year in the operating budget that passed the House, there is inflation proofing, just to note for the record.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understand that Senate Finance moved it out of committee today, and it didn't have the inflation proofing in it, and that was my concern.
Okay. Mine as well, Representative Knopp. Representative Birch.
Mine as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as the POMV structure, is it possible to, and I understand that the the Permanent Fund Board has long suggested that a percent of market value might be a reasonable approach to provide a predictable and sustainable level of revenue to the state for whatever purpose. Is it possible to do that outside the structure of an actual constitutional amendment? I mean, can you construct a model, if you will? I know it, I think it's SB 26, but there's been some discussion around that about how you would structure a POMV, a percent of market value, draw on a reliable basis, on an annual basis. And do you have any experience through the chair in other large funds? How would you, can you set that up outside? I worry about the entanglement of trying to get a constitutional amendment, but I support the idea of a POMV. I'm just trying to figure out how you get there without having to go through this exercise.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I think absolutely you can do it in statute, and there have been a number of statutes that have been proposed since I took this job in 2015. SB 26 has made it the farthest in terms of the legislative process. I think the challenge you face on the statutory front is that it's interesting. For 35 years, the statutes were followed completely and weren't open for debate, even though legislators were told, you have this money available for appropriation, you can cut this dividend, you can cut inflation proofing, you don't, this is your power under the Constitution. It was done as a matter of course, and there was no questioning about that. I think the concerns you hear about a statutory solution versus a constitutional solution is this recognition of the legislature's power of appropriation and what that means. And it means not appropriating for anything that's subject to appropriation and instituting that sort of political dynamic into things that in the past were not viewed as political. So from our standpoint, a constitutional amendment is probably, we would love a solution of any kind at this point, because this sort of ongoing year after year not knowing is very troubling. So if there was consensus around a statute, I personally believe that legislators would follow it, that they would be inclined to follow that newly created statute. But having said that, a constitutional amendment provides a level of comfort that a statute just can't get us there.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Follow up. Yeah, Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll just go ahead and play all my cards here right now, I guess, since I have you here. So I don't necessarily support the constitutional amendment. I think that to put the PFD, dividends or earnings reserve, in the Constitution is just poor public policy, number one. Number two, I think that the Constitution is a framework, a guiding principle, not to enshrine everything that you think needs to be in there. So that, for them two reasons, I do support a constitutional amendment if, in regards to inflation proofing. So that's just me, and I'm not sure that's the right decision, but that's just how I think. But I want to ask you, and I understand, I see what's going on with statutes and broad interpretations of statutes and appropriations and how we kind of mix the two up. But SB 26 does provide a structured draw, but I think what I like about 26 more than anything is it's got a three-year component to it. And since we never know what's going to happen or when it's going to happen, I think my question, Mr. Chairman, where I'm really going is your opinion on the two, the constitutional versus SB 26, and having that option in 3 years to take a second look at it.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, you know what's really interesting about the HJR 41 that's in front of you is that it's very simple. It's a draw, and how you spend that draw is entirely still open for debate. But the amount being drawn out of what we have historically referred to as the permanent fund is set at 4.5%. In terms of SB 26 and the look back, that 3-year look back, I think, is key to SB 26 being successful, because I think it's going to provide the information needed to know whether or not it's being overdrawn, if it needs to be reset, if the inflation, it has a mechanism for inflation proofing, and I know we're not speaking to that bill, but it does have a recognition, I will say, of the need for some inflation proofing on the principle of the fund. You know, one of the things with this HJR 41 is that if you spend, as the previous presenters talked about, well, if you had 8 years of 0% and you spent down the earnings reserve account, you still wouldn't touch the $40 billion. I would argue then that's maybe why you need to have a mechanism to move some of the earnings reserve account periodically over into the principal, some of those earnings, to boost that up. Because if you're truly trying to keep that limiter in there, then that's how you're going to keep the principal, maintain its purchasing power. But in any event, what this constitutional amendment does is it just makes a very simple, straightforward 4.75% draw. And it limits it to the amounts in the earnings reserve account. And so that's why I'm here today to talk about, because we can support this type of constitutional amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We saw a version of this bill not that long ago that had a 5% draw, and now it's a 4.75. Did something happen in the last 10 days? And what's going to happen in the next 10 days? Is it going to be 4.25? I'm just asking.
I was going to say,
before you answer, that might be best a question for me, because the version I was a work draft, not anything put on the record. And, I mean, Mr. Riddell, you can comment on this as well, but the question of what constitutes a sustainable draw is...
That's my question.
There's different schools of thought, and what's your... reflect that question to you, Mr. Riddell.
Mr. Chairman, the board has had a longstanding resolution in place supporting 5%. 4.75% is obviously more sustainable than 5% because you're taking less out. But that's a call for the policymakers as to what that percentage needs to be.
And just, I would add one comment to the question of sustainability. I and my office have recently had conversations with an economist. Many of the people in this room know Greg Erickson, the former publisher of the Budget Report, and he's a staunch advocate of a 4% draw. So just to give you a sense of the range of what people believe to be sustainable or prudent, it varies. Sorry, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the presenters initially said that this was a 4.75 sustainable draw, but then also presented the scenario of 8 years of zero return, hypothetically, of course, then suddenly your 4.75 may not be sustainable. However, it being in Constitution, it's, and it does say up to no more than 4.75, so I guess that would be up to the wisdom of the legislature, and we know that we've displayed immense wisdom. So I guess that may change the 4.75 as being sustainable, and then might you say, oh, based on this horrendous returns, maybe we shouldn't have put it in the Constitution. I mean, I'm not trying to throw doomsday scenarios out there, but I guess no one expects a zero returns for 8 years. Yet that's why there's a barrier between the earnings reserve and the principal. So I guess what are your thoughts on that? I know I just said a lot.
Through the chair, Representative Wall, I think that, it's important to talk about doomsday scenarios just to create an awareness that we don't know what the future holds in terms of investing in markets. And none of us expect to see zero or negative returns for 8 years straight. And, in the analyses that we've run in terms of stress analyses, we think that 4.75 and 5% are reasonably sustainable numbers for draws on this. I think, it becomes an interesting question because, as other members of the committee mentioned, the three-year look back, I suspect if this happened, there will come a time where I'm sitting in front of committees talking about what the balances are in the earnings reserve account, what the performance of the investments has been, and whether or not overdraws are potentially going to occur at some point. And so I think part of what is helpful in this constitutional amendment that I've seen in a lot of statutory language being proposed as well is smoothing it out of five out of the last six. So you're really creating a long time period, and the effective draws then end up being significantly less than the nominal draw of 4.75 or 5%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You also mentioned that you would like to see some kind of structure like this, so it takes away the uncertainty that you've been facing for the last few years. However, the last few years, there hasn't been a draw on the earnings reserve, and all the budget deficits have been made up for by draws on the CBR, which hasn't really affected how the permanent fund is managed. Is it just the anticipation of a draw that makes you guys on edge?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, it is, because and if you go back to the presentation I made a couple of weeks ago, when you talk about what it means to be prudent investors, it means following a very formal portfolio theory that takes into account distributions. So when the board is having to assemble its asset allocation and make a determination as to how to invest the fund, they should be taking into account the distribution requirement with that. And right now, we don't have a distribution requirement. It's anything between 0 and 100%. And so trying to manage successfully through that so that we can deliver maximum returns to the state while also recognizing that we have to protect the principal and not go all in on black, as they say, means that we would, knowing this, having this structure in place, will provide the sideboards through which then the board can make very real determinations as to how much can be put into illiquid investments like real estate, like private equity, that generate the big returns everybody's looking for.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question, not necessarily a follow-up, but you stated that you preferred, if you could be queen for a day or whatever, that you preferred a constitutional solution or constitutional formula like this as opposed to statutory, because statutory can be ignored to some extent. As far as the structure of the fund itself, I personally do a constitutional draw of up to 4.75%. I would like to see it just one, you know, super fund or whatever you want to call it, a true endowment. I keep something like
super funds or something else.
But. Yeah, I know. Well, consistent draw of 4.75%. What remains in the fund essentially is counts as inflation proofing. And if you took too much that it wasn't inflation proofing, well, then you're taking too much. And so you have a set fund with a set draw, and that's it. And I know the answer, but I'm going to ask anyways, would that be your preference in the hierarchy of options here?
Through the chair, absolutely, that would be our preference. Okay,
thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Riddell? Thank you for joining us. And Mr. Teal has arrived. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Teal? Thank you for joining us, if just to listen in. Seeing no other committee questions or comments on HR 41, I'm going to set this aside. It's not my intent to move this bill, at least at this time. It may yet come back before us. It's an important conversation. And thank you, Mr. Magdans and Mr. Irving, for joining us today. That takes us to the next item on today's agenda, HB 409, relating to DMV ID cards and registration fees. This is a committee bill partly born out of indirect expenditure report from Legislative Finance and the Finance Subcommittee process. We have to present the bill Kathy Schlinghide in my office, as well as Marla Thompson, Division of Motor Vehicles Director online, and Mike Stinker with the Department of Law. Ms. Schlinghide, welcome. Please put yourself on the record and present HB 409.
For the record, this is Kathy Schlinghide, staff to Representative Chris Tompkins. HB 409 is a State Affairs Committee bill, came out of, as was mentioned, statutory recommendations from the Department of Administration Finance Subcommittee. It updates and streamlines the statutes for greater efficiency at the Division of Motor Vehicles and addresses some of the identified indirect expenditures in the division. We have a new fiscal note that was just distributed before the meeting on members' desks, estimating it would generate revenue of around $815,000 per year. Section 1 of the bill, this one is specifically one of the Finance Subcommittee's statutory recommendations. It standardizes the age for senior discounts. It's 65 for the senior registration fee waiver, and this would make it the same for the identification card registration fee waiver. Section 2 of the bill allows people to opt to let DMV use the United States Post Office database to update their addresses. Right now, DMV, even if they see your address has been set updated at the post office, has to mail to what they know is the wrong address, have it bounce back, and then reach out to you. So this would allow you to opt to let them just mail it to the new address. Section 3 removes the vehicle registration fee exemption for amateur radio operators. It's around 44 beneficiaries per year. Section 4 is another statutory recommendation. It's an indirect expenditure of around $498,000 per year. It would eliminate the exemption for municipalities and give partial exemption to charitable organizations, so it would be partial recovery of the indirect costs. Section 5 is setting a fee for the DMV knowledge tests at $5 and raising the fee for the DMV road tests from $15 to $25. This would both raise revenue for the state and increase efficiency at DMV by hopefully reducing the no-show rates, which is around 20% for the driving test. And the fail rate right now for the knowledge test, which has unlimited free attempts, is now at 60%. Section 6 is just statutory cleanup. It's various insurance and accident reporting thresholds. They originally were set the same for DMV and DOT, that the report needs to be set when it's $501. DOT has been updated, so it's now a $2,000 threshold, but the DMV limit has not been updated or adjusted for inflation in 33 years. It still sits at $501, so it would bring it up to 2000, and this is also in Section 7, 8, 9, 10, and 13, just throughout the statute, updating that threshold. Section 11 addresses the SR-22, which is a vehicle liability insurance document for high-risk insurance policy. People are required to have it after an accident or traffic offense, and this section would say that you're required to maintain it for 10 years rather than for a lifetime to prevent undue financial hardship. Section 12 allows for a new installment payment plan instead of automatic suspension of a license when you have your license suspended for an outstanding financial judgment. Section 13, again, just raising the threshold from 501 to 2000. And Section 14 is cleanup for Section 2, allowing the address to be updated based off of the post office. This just removes the requirement that you notify DMV as long as you've opted in to let the post office update them.
Thank you, Ms. Schlinghein. Before we get to questions, should note that this is merely a starting point. This is an amalgam of indirect expenditure recommendations from Alleged Finance, Finance Subcommittee recommendations, and recommendations from DMV. So the committee process begins now. Any questions for Ms. Schlinghein or Ms. Thompson? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 11, SR-22, Section 11. I assume that really has little to do with the DMV, but just a policy call, because buying SR-22 insurance is between the driver or the driver and the insurance company and not the DMV. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, the statutes for DMV is that you provide proof of financial responsibility, so you have to submit to them a form essentially showing that you've bought the SR-22 insurance. So this would, after 10 years, eliminate the requirement that you submit that form to DMV.
Thank you. Maybe this is a question for the DMV, because I was someone that did have to buy SR-22 insurance at one time in my long and illustrious career, but it wasn't for 10 years. It was for shorter than that. And now if it's gone from to lifetime, so if you have any accident, you have to buy SR-22 for life currently? Is that the law?
I'm direct that to Ms. Thompson. Ms. Thompson, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and speak to Rep. Wohl's question.
Hi, for the record, this is Marla Thompson with the DMV. Can you hear me okay?
As best as we can in this room, which is no fault of yours, although if you're on a headset or if you're on speaker, please go to a handset. But yes, we can hear you. Please proceed.
Okay, great. I might have to throw a lifeline out for Michael Sanker on this one, but it is not, SR-22 is not required for most judgments for more than a few years, but for some things there are for a lifetime, so we wanted to only have to have it maintained for 10 years. But it's not for a normal DUI SR-22. That's normally 5 years.
Follow up?
A little bit further.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for what infractions is a lifetime SR-22 required? I'm just curious. I'm not trying to stall the bill presentation.
That's fine. Michael, can you rein in on that one, please?
Mr. Sanker, please go ahead. Put yourself on the record.
Yeah, for the record, Michael Sanker, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of DMV. Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I would have to conduct some additional research and get back to the committee on all the instances where an SR-22 is required and for the lengths of time for those different conditions.
Thank you.
Sorry, I can't answer the question directly now.
Other questions from the committee? Wow. I think I have a question. Nope, I don't. Anybody else? All right, going once, going twice, section 14 section bill, gone. This will be coming back before us, Representative Johnson, don't worry. just a first hearing. Hopefully we'll have some further research from the Department of Law. Representative Wohl, go ahead.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. The ham radio 44, I do know one of them, and I'll probably be hearing from him in the next number of days.
And Representative Wohl, I think I know the second of those 44.
Yeah.
Probably the same here. Next bill on today's agenda is SB 204, just a first hearing from Senator Egan's office. Mr. Nayrose is here to present the bill. Please go ahead, put yourself on the record, Mr. Nayrose, and present the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the House State Affairs Committee, my name is Peter Nayrose, staff to Senator Egan. I'm here this afternoon to introduce SB 204 to the committee. Senator Egan appreciates very much you having this hearing, and you asking for SB 204 to be heard. He apologizes for not being here in person. Briefly, SB 204 is drafted to return chiropractors to a list of people who can authorize qualified individuals with disabilities to get handicap parking placards and license plates. The Alaska Division of Motor Vehicles offers several types of disability parking placards and license plates, temporary, permanent, and those that are on the that are shown on the license itself. Until 2016, the DMV's process allowed for chiropractors to be among those that qualified individuals for those plates and permits. In 2016, the Attorney General, after reviewing the statutes and authorizations, determined that chiropractors were not specifically mentioned. So SB 204 does that. In Section 1, of which there's only one section, it specifies the types of chiropractors, and those are the ones that are listed in accordance with AS 08-20. So, Mr. Chairman, we think this is a good bill for the public at large, for those people who have disabilities and don't want to, that shouldn't have to pay for an additional visit to a doctor or a nurse practitioner, and who are already under treatment from a chiropractor. So, with that, I'll be glad to attempt to answer any questions the committee, any members may have.
Questions from the committee for Mr. Nayrose? A studied silence. Going once. Going twice.
I have a comment, but I'm not sure it's appropriate.
Representative, what would you like to make an appropriate comment?
No, I'll abstain from right for now.
All right. Thank you for joining us. I will set an amendment deadline and for the second hearing, as well as notice public testimony, as is the custom in this committee. I'll be in touch, or my office will be in touch with members by email on what that deadline will be. And while we're at it, probably do the same for HB 409, the DMV bill that we just heard, and potentially HGR 41. So thank you very much, Mr. Nayrose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next piece of legislation, I don't see the sponsor here for, so we're going to take the next two pieces of legislation I don't see the sponsors here for, so we're going to take a brief at ease. This is the first hearing of HJR 30. Please put yourself on the record and present the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andy Josephson. I represent House District 17. It is the University Medical Center part of Anchorage. And before you today is House Joint Resolution number 30. This was, to be honest, the inspiration of a Colony Middle School student. I met with her in the fall. She came to Juneau in the January-February timeframe, presented this resolution with me, of course, to the House Committee on Community and Regional Affairs. I shared this interest with her, the resolution, the interest I speak of, is a resolution that expresses concern and sympathy
and compassion for refugees and displaced persons. It originally we were looking at a focus on Syrian refugees, but the resolution is broader than that, and it is designed to reflect sort of this historical moment and the compassion of the Alaska legislature and concern for folks who are displaced based on civil strife and based on, for example, their fear of sexual violence, human trafficking, forced conscription, genocide, and other horrible situations they might confront. And so it's fairly self-explanatory. And I think given the circumstances in Syria this week, it's unfortunately topical. And that's my presentation.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Questions from the committee on HJR 30. Going once, going twice, gone. Thank you, Representative Josephson. Okay, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want Representative Josephson to come all the way down here and not be asked one question. So,
my office is on the first floor, but that's fine.
You don't need a handicap permit. 65,600,000 people are displaced worldwide. What would your sense of the responsibility or obligation that the United States should try to absorb?
Well, this subject came up through the chair. This subject came up a bit in Community and Regional Affairs. There are some that believe that we're not fully doing our fair share given our resources and capacity, and that the burden is being held more by Western Europe, for example, than ourselves. The intent wasn't so much to get into that issue as to just, as so many resolutions do, mark this moment in history and note that the people of Alaska and their legislature are compassionate people, and that we're aware of the crisis. And if called upon, we would certainly lend a hand. And beyond being called upon, that we would individually, if not collectively, that we would assert ourselves and do whatever we can do.
Representative Ledoux.
What did you have in mind that we can do? I mean, what exactly do you want to see with respect to this resolution? What are we not doing that you think we should do, Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, the resolution directs that the United States government do what it can in partnership with the international community, that it work with non-governmental organizations, that it mitigate the harm, that it use its resources as it can, and sort of those sort of things should continue. And to the extent they've ebbed at all, they should be reinforced.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll have a second hearing, notice public testimony, have an amendment deadline, all TBD, and my office will be in touch by email on those subjects. Thank you, Representative Josephson. And this takes us to the last item on today's agenda, item 5 of 5, SB 196, from the Senate Finance Committee, specifically Senators Von Imhoff and Machiki, who I have an understanding are nearby or representatives thereof. We'll go on to take a brief at ease while people filter in. Back on the record, the fifth item on today's agenda, SB 196, relating to an appropriation limit. Welcome, Senators Machiki and Von Imhoff. This is a first hearing. Please put yourself on the record and present the legislation.
Thanks very much for having us today. Mr. Chairman and committee members. Before I start, I'd just like to point out we've done some statewide polling, and very interesting thing that we realized is the percentage of people that support a spending limit. It's not party specific. It's not specific to any particular region of the state or any demographic. It's has a very high level of support. In fact, in every region, it was above 75%. Why is that important? We rely on a single commodity to fund more than 85% of our government services. And although we have cut the operating capital budgets by over $3 billion in the last four fiscal years, we continue to draw from our savings accounts to fill the gap between revenue and expenditures. This bill before you sets an appropriation limit. And I have a chart that I'm going to share with you. I don't know if it's on members' desks. If not, we will get it to you. But the chart looks like this. And what it demonstrates is sort of our spending limit plotted in a couple of different ways. I'm sorry if you don't have the chart. We will get it for
it's
you.
It's in the packet. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So what you see is the top line, the purple line, is the existing statutory appropriation limit. Right? Haven't come close in the last 10 years or so when you talk about operating, because that's what this deals with. The red line is the actual spend. And then there's two lines I want you to look at. They're at parallel. The blue line is deflating from the current spend back to around 1999. The green line is inflating at this appropriation limit trend, if you will, up until today. And what are we trying to demonstrate here? What we're trying to demonstrate is the reason why this is important, no matter what side of the aisle, no matter what body, no matter what type of Alaskan you are, is we've gotten back into this band. And had we avoided getting out of this band, we would have approximately $15 billion more in savings right now. We wouldn't have reduced dividends. We wouldn't have been talking about broad-based taxes. And we would have been delivering quality, constitutionally protected services in the meantime. There may have been some other choices that we didn't make. What this bill allows us to do, what this bill requires us to do, is to prioritize our spending going forward so we don't find ourselves in the same situation again. I'm going to hand it off to Senator Von Imhoff to touch on it, and then I'm happy to do a sectional if you so desire, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. For the record, thank you. This is Senator Von Imhoff. Mr. Chair, we live in a feast or famine type of environment with a primary single source of revenue in oil. And we can effectively live in that environment if we have a control over our spending so that our spending doesn't necessarily match the revenues that may jump or may fall over the course of time. And if you look back in history, you will see that not only between fiscal years 2010 and 2014, when we had huge jumps in revenue, we've had these feasts and famines even in the past. And what we've done is we've successfully, over the last 25 years, have put money away in the Constitutional Budget Reserve, and we've borrowed from that during times when we needed to fund the deficits. What we did not do between 2010 and 2014 was control our spending. We matched our spending to revenue, and when revenue started falling in 2015, we could not contract our spending fast enough. As a result, to what Senator Michiki stated, we left about $15 billion on the table by money that we did not put into savings during the good years and additional money that we took out to cover very large deficits because we had large budgets during the falling revenue years. What SB 196 does is help a spending limit helps future growth in spending, so we avoid the big jumps and the big falls in drops in spending, and that which creates so much anxiety and uncertainty in our state. What this bill does is it grows spending over time in a very predictable rate based on what most other states use, which is usually the CPI for their state, Consumer Price Index. And it is agreed upon set of principles that the legislature, the entire body legislature, agrees to set their budgets on each year. A spending cap brings predictability and sustainability to our budget process and is a key ingredient to be able to do a biannual budget, which is a two-year budget, which I think then avoids a lot of the conversation we're talking about with pink slips and educators and other things. So I feel that it's a bill to ease the anxiety and provide predictability and sustainability. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Representative Ledoux.
Well, I actually support the concept of a spending limit, but my question is, why do you think that the legislature will adhere to a spending limit, because it's in statute any more than we've adhered to, for example, paying out the permanent fund dividend according to the formula that is in the statute? I mean, our track record as to following the statutes is sometimes not 100%.
I think that's an excellent question, and I'll tell you what we've been discussing in our majority is the fact that this is a test. The real objective is that this translates into a constitutional spending limit. We just want to make sure we have it right. It has a look back. If we do have it right, I'm very hesitant to change the Constitution until we know that we have something that's somewhat time-tested. If we find that we're successful, so soon after we pass statutory items that the legislature weighs in on heavily and heavily supports, we have a tendency to stay very close to that. In time, as new legislators come in, they're not particularly married to that past statutory structure. But I think we have time in the next 2 years that if this proves to be the right trend of spend going forward, that you would see a constitutional amendment that hopefully the people of Alaska would support.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is great. I know at the municipal level, you know, we have tax caps, and there's always some sort of institutional limits or boundaries on spending, and I think it's good, and maybe it can be modified over time, but I think it's always helpful to have a roadmap or a target, if you will, for spending, and I think it's certainly something that I've seen a need for just in my limited time here, and I think it is helpful, and I appreciate the idea of bringing this forward, and look forward to an opportunity to support it. Thank you.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, senators, both of you. So, in your sponsor statement, I agree with the fact that you're making exemptions for the payment of permanent funds, capital projects, state debt obligations, but I'm a little concerned about the receipt-supported services because, as you both know, that we really, truly don't have DGF funds. And so, and every department now has receipt-supported services, and so you don't seem to be capping them anywhere. And as you've seen the last couple of years, pretty much every department has raised fees in one form or another. So any thoughts on that? Should that have been something that maybe should have fallen under UGF? Or, you know, we've really strayed, I think, from what we said. It's not GGF, but we're calling it GGF. So help me out there.
Thank you, Representative Knopp. We had discussions about what a spending cap might include. UGF, undesignated general funds, only, or all state funds, including DGF and other state funds. We landed on UGF because we felt it was important to provide the departments, the university, the flexibility to raise fees what they believe the market will bear. The university, for example, is subsidized by the state more than any other Western university, and President Johnson has stated that on the record. If the university wishes to raise tuition, we ought to be able to allow them to do that and not necessarily be stymied by a spending cap. Same goes with hunting fees, fishing regulations. There is a point where market equilibrium will dictate what price is too high or not, and we felt that that was more appropriate to have the divisions or the departments to retain that autonomy and flexibility.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Walton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this graph we have in front of us, and I guess Senator Machicki was explaining it, you said we've left the band. I'm assuming that's between the parallel green line and the parallel blue line, and the red line is our spending. It looks to this graph like we're actually back in the band the last couple years. Am I reading that right?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, that is correct. The $15 billion that disappeared is the difference between the blue line and the red line when the red line is outside of the two parallel lines.
Thank you. And the statement that 85% of our government services relies on a single commodity, that statement is probably no longer valid and may not be for some time in the foreseeable future. How would you adjust that statement, I guess?
Well, I don't know that I would, because if a POMV passes or any other arrangement that's going to pay our bills, it's still single commodity generated with escalation from earnings. You're converting, of course, production from the past into funding for the future. So I don't know that you moved outside of that band. I think you picked up a higher proportion of that band and likely will in perpetuity, particularly if we can get an agreement on what our spending should look like today and how it should escalate in the future. The primary point of this chart is, with relatively little discomfort, we are back in that band. It's obviously doable because as a team we've done it together with UGF spending. If we can maintain being within that band in the future, we can avoid those spikes in spending with some outlets for things that, when we do have high revenues, we have the ability to catch up on things like deferred maintenance and other projects that may be lagging at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the red line of spending, your bill proposes that the $4.1 billion won't include capital projects. Does the red line of spending also follow that same exclusion of capital projects, because I believe that's a big part of the deduction from, say, 2014 to 2018.
This discussion is apples to apples on operating.
Okay, thank you.
Along those lines, has there been any thought about extending the spending cap to the capital budget? And I just think from the boom years when the gravy train was really running the capital budget, I mean, the operating budget definitely reflected it, but the capital budget certainly reflected it, too. Has that conversation happened?
Thank you, Representative Christ-Tompkins. There has been some discussion about a waterfall, potentially, that if oil revenues or other revenues exceed the spending cap, what gets priority on a maybe a certain percentage or a certain dollar amount, when you have competing interests such as PERS and TERS, debt payments, repayment to the CBR, capital, maybe even school education, building matching funds, things of that nature. We've had those discussions. We have not necessarily landed on anything at this point. We are open to feedback. But to get back to, just to answer Representative Wolves, you are correct that oil revenue has been in the past a much higher percentage of revenue Absent of a POMV, it still remains the highest or dominant revenue force. One would argue that even with a POMV in its own way, it is from oil revenue in its origin. Moving forward, we believe that starting with a 4.1 UGF is realistic based in the world market of what we can afford with oil revenue now and the production that we have now and the opportunities that we have through SB 21, the oil tax credits, the oil taxes. And we feel that this is a realistic, based on what information we have now, makes sense. But as Senator Michiki said, this is going to be a trial period. It has a three-year look back, which we will look at it then and see whether the rate makes sense. The rate that's in our Constitution now, as you can see, is a little high. It's both population and CPI. It's too big of a growth rate. It doesn't work. We probably should have looked at it maybe 10 or 20 years ago. This provision has a three-year look back, which is why we put that in there. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator von Imhoff and Senator Michiki, thank you, I guess, for pointing out or stating that the source of revenue originally was oil. It went into a fund, and now the source that the fund has been invested, we're using that as our number one source of revenue if, in fact, we do access that fund, which all expectations say yes. So it's not direct oil, but it's had oil on it. The consumer price index, would that take into account, say, something like health care, where surge in health care costs, which goes up quite a bit higher than inflation, affects PERS and TERS and other agency expenditures when we have health insurance and all these things that a lot of agencies see a big increase from that? I'm assuming that's included.
I believe CPI is everything. We have an Anchorage CPI, which is in essence the statewide CPI. We're one of the few states that has the dominant city representing the state. I have a 30-year look back here, and the CPI ranges in 2016 negative 0.1 all the way to about 4.6 in one given year. So it does fluctuate when the price of oil and the price of housing and healthcare goes up, but then it goes down. It's level over time. When you look at it over time, it's pretty level and the numbers work.
Thank you.
On the subject of CPI, are there, not being a Bureau of Labor Statistics wonk, are there any sort of idiosyncrasies in CPI where you could have a CPI calculated for Anchorage that in any way has a large delta from what the sort of effective or de facto statewide CPI would be? Is there anything to look into there? I realize that's an open-ended question.
So a very direct example of that was right when the price of oil went from $107 a barrel down to $29. You're going to see an offset. You're going to see a state that's used to a very high level of revenue, many more high-paying jobs, rents were up, renting a storefront, many materials were at a much higher price, and suddenly you had a revenue drop. So there are times when there's a lag. But considering it is the actual cost of the primary drivers to the cost of living in Anchorage, it generally catches up in a relatively short order. The reason that capital is excluded is because you can shut it off like a faucet, like we did. That is not our problem in spending. It can be a problem in spending. When you're building community centers in the middle of nowhere that unfortunately have operating dollars attached to them, that can be a problem. But as you saw in 14 and 15, we were able to make that immediate reduction. You don't have bodies attached to it. You don't have employees and their families attached to it. You don't have their health care and their retirement and all that other burden that's so difficult to reduce. So UGF spend in our operating budget is the key exposure, and that is what made this so uncomfortable over the last couple of years, and where, in my view, we are still not spending at the place where we should be spending for a state of 740,000 people.
Further questions? Senators, thank you very much for joining us. We'll bring the bill back before the committee at a future date. It's noticed for Thursday. We'll be in touch if anything changes on that point, but thank you. It's noticed for Thursday. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Machiki.
Sectional, but if you please, amongst yourselves, can just, it'll give you the limitations and any questions for us that we can prepare in advance. We're happy to do so.
Thank you very much for coming down. And that's the fifth of five pieces of legislation. We're back on Thursday for all the same pieces of legislation noticed. And at 4:37, we're adjourned.